and welcome to another episode of BitNote. We'll be talking about video games and video game music. And this episode, I'll be tackling a game that's come up a few times before, but I've never really gone into fully, Portal 2, and we'll be playing some of the great music from it. So let's start off with the main theme, so to speak, of Portal, which is called Music of the Spheres. So have a listen, and we'll get right into all about why this is such a well-known music track. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy, and have a listen. And that was Music of the Spheres. It was from the soundtrack, of course, of Portal 2 by Mike Moraski. So, what is Portal 2, in case you don't know? Well, I've mentioned already its prequel, of course, Portal, but basically, it's about one woman's struggle to actually break out of this insane testing facility where she is a test subject, which seems to be ruled over by some maniacal, utterly psychotic computer. The first game has it all pretty standard. You wake up in the test center and have to do a huge series of arbitrary tests involving this strange portal gun that basically lets you Well, the portal mechanics are a little tricky to explain without the use of diagrams, but essentially it lets you put one opening on a wall right beside you and another opening on a wall across that's a far distance away, and then you could just step through the portal. It's a portal gun that creates portals, so it's like wormholes or little very fast ways of like making doors that have one side that opens right beside you and another side of the door open a far distance away. So you go through this testing facility, having to test out this portal gun in a wide variety of crazy ways before you finally realize that things are getting way too insane. The computer tries to kill you, and you're desperately trying to just break out and just finally end up confronting the computer and continuing on. In a somewhat controversial thing, the first game actually had its ending changed. It ended originally where, you know, after a whole lot of destruction, you wake to find yourself finally... Everything was happening underground, by the way. You wake to finally find yourself outside in the sunshine, looking at the aperture, looking at the science lab from the outside, and you're happy that whatever happened, you had this moment being released. But then they released a software update that actually changed this, so now that suddenly, if you played it back when it came out, you would have felt you'd been released, but then suddenly they changed it to add this ending where suddenly you were recaptured at the end of it, which is kind of crazy. It's not unusual to change games after they've been released using with patches, but that's normally to actually remove bugs, not to actually change the entire narrative of it. So essentially, Portal 2 has you waking up yet again, trapped in the same science facility. The twist is that instead of it seems that the maniacal computer has been defeated, and also it seems to be a huge, huge amount of time in the future. Apparently you were spending the time in suspended animation, and on top of that, it looks like the whole place has been completely overgrown, abandoned, and you're basically going through what's basically an echo of what has happened. To add things to it, you've got this rather idiotic computer who speaks with a British accent and is happily trying to tell you everything that they need to do in order to get out of here. Although whether you trust him to know what the heck he's doing is completely another situation entirely, but that kind of gets a lot of rapport going early on in the game as you make your way through the same overgrown test facilities that you saw the previous time and end up going on this whole journey that will take you through crazy parts of the facility. And yes, the maniacal computer will finally make a reappearance, because it was that would be spoiling it, but let's be honest, she was never going to stay out of this for the whole time. So before I go into a little more about what Portal 2 does that really ups the ante and everything, why don't I play some more music? Now, Mike Moraski has done some great music for both this and the last game. Of course, he's the composer at Valve. Valve is the company that made Portal 2. And he's had quite an eclectic selection of music tunes for this one. I'm going to play now what I just played was Music of the Spheres, which is the theme of the game, but right now I'll try playing you the Die Cut Laser Dance, which I think has got a lot of really interesting it kind of just shows just a bit of good example of some of the music in this game. So have a listen. Thank you. And that was Die Cut Laser Dance from Portal 2, of course. That actually happens at an interesting part of the game. Basically, you literally get to see this gigantic sheets of metal pass you, and then these huge industrial lasers actually cut out patterns in the metal sheets right in front of you. Portal 2 is a lot of that, actually. A lot of games work on the basic gameplay. You go from one sequence to another. But sometimes, like in Doom 3 did a lot of this, there's some really nice like graphical effects, like basically eye candy in order to show how it was happening. One interesting part in the game is actually seeing how the portals are assembled, but that's a whole other thing. This game has popped up in this show a few times. When I was interviewing the developer of Tesla, Glenn Morin, he actually had us play Robots FTW, which is a track from the game. And also more recently, Spencer Riedel, the composer in Charlotte Seeker, basically used Portal 2 as an example of how everything built itself up, how the music was actually a part of the experience. For instance, sometimes if you do these special things like, you know, bounce on this gel or whatever, it doesn't exactly create a sound effect as such, it more creates a musical accompaniment to the background track. And then as you gradually create puzzles, another layer is added to the music, so it actually makes the music interactive to how the puzzle is solved, and it basically has the whole atmosphere to how it's done. In a way, it fades into the background. That's actually a problem I have with a lot of games when I'm reviewing this on the show. I'm saying, what, that game? But did it actually have musical accompaniment? And the truth is, you know, the music usually fits in the game and so well that you actually have to pay attention to it. And that's what this show has had me do. It's had me to actually pay attention to the music in the background and ruining them, because now I'm actually not really, but it does show that, you know, if you're not listening for music, it can just fade in subconsciously and it just affects how you appreciate it. If you want any of the tracks from this, actually, it's very easy to get. Valve have, quite thankfully, made the entire Portal 2 album completely free to download on their Portal 2 website. That is awesome of them, I have to say. I mean, it's just often for some old games, it's hard to even actually get the music from the game. And sometimes you can buy it on a site like Bandcamp is great for this, for downloading soundtracks. But for Valve to say, like, just have the entire album for free, that is completely awesome. As I said, the game is a puzzle game. You use portals to get through the area, and it's fun. But there is actually one part of the game that I think actually is much better than the original and just hasn't been done before. It is the co-op function. So essentially with Portal 2, in the single player game, it's a lot like the first game. You have all these puzzles, you have all these technical things to work through. You got to lay down portals and everything and try to figure out how all the systems interact with each other. And then there's that. Sometimes, for instance, the laser might be pointing at this wall. So you put a portal where the laser is being pointed and a portal somewhere else. So the laser suddenly comes out of a completely new location and then hopefully hits the sensor that'll trigger something else happening. So every time you're in a test area, you basically figure out where the exit is and figure out what sort of bizarre set of events you need to get enact in order to get yourself over to the test center. Where it's different is that there's also a co-op thing where essentially it's not just you going, there's actually you and a friend or someone you don't know suddenly find yourself both in the test chamber and you both have to work together to get out of it. Now, I've always had a fondness for co-op as being cooperative. There was an arcade game like in the 90s called Lucky and Wild, and the great thing about that was that it was a driving and shooting game at the same time. So there were a lot of like arcade games where you'd shoot at the screen, and there were a lot of arcade games where you'd drive with a steering wheel and pedals. Lucky and Wild let you do both, so you drove but you also shot at the screen while you were driving. So what I'd often like to do is just play in a credit and then just get someone to, you know, either they'd drive and I'd shoot, and it would be fun because, you know, we'd be both working together and having a lot of skills. Now, there have been a lot of co-op games that have been developed recently. I mean, Valve themselves, who made Portal 2, have also made like Left 4 Dead and Team Fortress 2. But the thing about both these games is that you don't really need to communicate with the other person at any point. In Left 4 Dead 2, there are zombies coming at you. It doesn't take a genius to say, let's all shoot the zombies. And while there's some areas that require you to cooperate a little bit more, if you're relatively skillful player, you can figure out what needs to be done, take the role and do it. The same thing happens with Team Fortress 2, for instance. I mean, there's the medic who will keep someone at health, and then there's the heavy who takes a lot of damage. So the genius is that if you're a medic, you heal the heavy, and if you're heavy, you wait until a medic comes. And there's a whole lot of, actually, Team Fortress 2 is fantastic for this because there's a whole lot of behaviors and strategies you generally learn and apply normally without cooperation. So it's almost fascinating insight into how, even without communication, how you can like cooperate with each other and develop stratagems and stuff. But when it comes to Portal 2 and the co-op, And neither of those strategies are enough. You could do about 100 random things, both of you together, and it won't get you off the platform. You two are basically walking around this area. You're both able to leave a set of portals, so you've got basically four portals to leave down. But that's just not enough. You need to know how to actually leave, put down the portals in the right way, in the right sequence, how to interact with the lasers and all the jumps and the bumps and all the cubes and everything. And, you know, you actually have to cooperate with someone. I managed to contact a friend I had online, and we were both game for it. It was very tricky to do it, because if one person knows how to do all the puzzles already, then of course the whole thing is spoiled. So for my first time doing this, I had to choose someone who hadn't done it as well, so we could work together. And honestly, it was great. We set up, at first we communicate with text, and it was tricky enough, but then we actually managed to get a voice call going, and it's just that sort of cooperation. I just love it, because you're looking around, you're thinking, you might do something and the other person says, wait a sec, that gives me an idea, or they might do something and you give it an idea. And it also kind of teaches you about, you know, communicating with other people, because maybe you've got an idea, but the other person but the other person has a different idea. So whose idea are you going to go for? Do you want to just disregard the other person and go for it, which might annoy you, but get the puzzle solved differently? Or do you want to actually try to cooperate them? If you think they're telling a terrible idea, do you go along with it, or do you try to force ahead your idea, or then do you trust them? And then it's this whole human interaction thing, because you realize it's not just about solving the puzzle. That's a really cool task to do. It's also about getting on with the person so you can just push forward and hopefully complete the game with each other. And I've always liked this, because as much as I've loved video games, I love it when games bring people together. I love it when games get people interacting and talking and chatting, and there were so many fun experiences. For instance, there's a way you can use portals in order. There are these things called light bridges, and essentially you have this bridge going across. And so sometimes one of us would be walking across a bridge and someone would move their portal, so the light bridge disappears. And suddenly one of us accidentally causes the other to fall to their death. Obviously this leads to some emotion. But then one time my friend was actually going across it, and I'll spare you the details, but he did something that accidentally made his own portals disappear without him realizing it, and suddenly his bridge fell. He fell to his death, and he just swore at me. I was like, dude, it wasn't my fault. You did it yourself. And he said, oh, I did. I'm sorry. And it's just funny, because when one of your friends accidentally dies in a video game, it's just all for the humor factor. And that's what I like. Good games are good when they're as much fun when things go wrong as when they do it right. And that's how it happened. There were a lot of things going. There's faith plates that bump you around. There's all this sort of stuff. And the old challenge is just trying to, you know, work with each other and have a fun time and have a fun experience. And we really did enjoy that. And then at one stage, we even had like a third guy join in, and I used desktop screening so he could see what we did. And my friend actually had an interesting thing, though. We had a lot of portal turrets in the game. These are like sentient turrets that kill you. And most of the time I destroy them, but my friend kind of had an aversion to them being destroyed. So if we could, and you know, we'd try to like move them so they like put them into the corner and face the corner so they wouldn't hit any. It was kind of funny that way. Anyway, I'm going to play one more track from this. This is a very interesting track that plays at a very interesting part in the game. In the last game, there was this part called Still Alive, which pretty much everyone knew, and I played, and it was a very fun song. The game didn't have quite as memorable tracks, but there is one bit of track, and I think it's beautiful, and it plays in a very unexpected part of the game. I won't spoil anything, and that's why I'm not playing the actual final track, because that kind of does spoil things, but I think this one is pretty amazing in its own regard. So have a listen. Thank you. And that was Cara Mia Addio by Mick Moraski from Portal 2 by Valve. And one other thing I mentioned about Portal 2 is that it also lets you make your own levels, which is a lot of fun. I made a level that just let me portal around doing crazy stuff. At one point I had this spring that shot a cube through one of my portals, then it came out another portal, and it lands on the spring, so it sprang right back through the first portal. And it continues being springing up around, hit the spring again, and I just watched it and laughed. So, fun times. On to my next track, and what will be the last track. Yes, I actually do manage to have a little bit of time for something else here. I try to play and preferably try to complete every video game before I actually play the music on this show. Sometimes this is not possible. Sometimes it's because I played the game a while back, and sometimes because the game was hard and I never quite finished it, and trying to start all the way again would be a bit too much trouble. But sometimes it's because the game in question is Shadow of the Beast, the Mega Drive version, by Reflections Interactive. The reason why Shadow of the Beast is an exception is a problem is quite simply this. I start Shadow of the Beast. I actually read the instruction manual. I had a very interesting story. It's about a slave who suddenly fights for the freedom and all this sort of stuff. And I mean, I really loved how it was written in the instruction manual. It reminded me a bit of Red Fraction, actually. Brilliant instruction manual writing. But when I actually started the game, it didn't seem to match up. When I played Shadow of the Beast, I saw this whole thing about a slave getting freedom. I started the game. I was a guy in a field. I had two options as a my newly emancipated slave. I could either run left or I could run right. If I ran left, I found this well. If I went down the well and I couldn't go any further left, I had to go down the well at that point, I'd find myself in a great big cavern sort of thing, which I struggled around. I'd punch monsters and go up until finally I found myself in this area where basically this gigantic bone monstrosity vehicle was heading towards me like a wall of doom. I didn't know what to do. If I ran in the other direction, I hit into a wall and the doom monster vehicle thing would crash into me and kill me instantly. And if I tried to punch it, I might get one hit before suddenly it would crash into me anyway. I looked at the back of the box manual and I apparently saw that my character had some sort of, you know, power pellet punch thing that would shoot these projectiles across at the thing, but I had no idea how to actually instantiate this. So every time I went, got to that area, I struggled through it to get to that area, I would either get crushed by that thing one way or the other. What's more is, unfortunately, this was the that this did not have continues or anything. You die once, you lost the entire. You had to start again all the way from the beginning. Back in the field, back in walking left across the field, back down the well, back through the cavern, all the way back to that gigantic monstrosity heading towards me to try to figure out once again how to defeat this thing. And in the 5, 10, maybe 10 seconds it took to have a shot at actually trying to figure this thing, I would die. And if I tried to punch it, I might get, like I said, one hit, it would kill me, I'd die. So that's what happened if I went left. If I went right, oh boy. For a start, I would walk across this gigantic plain. It would take ages. Everything would try to kill me. There would be rocks that would come out of things for no reason. I mean, why the heck were they rocks? There'd be bats. And scarily enough, gigantic skeleton hands, larger than the size of me, would suddenly come out of the ground, reach up, like snap their fingers. I don't know what they did. That's how I always remembered it. They were snapping their fingers. Probably not what happened. They would snap their fingers, descend back into the earth and keep doing it. So it was a gauntlet. Everything was trying to kill me. I would just be walking across green plain trying to take as least damage as possible by shooting all these, by hitting, punching, killing all these things. Finally, I'd get to a castle. I'd go into the castle and I would say, oh, wait a second, you know, it's too dark. And if I went too far, the screen would black out and I would have to go back unless I wanted to take my chances, which would probably get me killed. Fortunately, when I went out of the castle, I would see a torch fully lit on the outside of the castle, so apparently they have fully lit torches on the outside of castles during daytime. I'd jump up and grab the torch, go back in, and that was solved. So hurrah, some things in this game were easy. So then I would go down, I'd start navigating the castle, but I'd be already on low health from traversing the gigantic plain, and then I'd get killed again. And that would be what happened, and I tried it a few times. Sometimes I could try it so I had more health, but that castle was too chaotic, and I would die. And that would happen if I went right. So, that's pretty much how the game left for me. Go left to get killed by a crush thing, go right to get killed while either trying to traverse a plane while everything was, while all these random things were trying to kill me, and finally get to a castle where I'd spend the last time being with one basic puzzle and then end up being killed by whatever happened there. As you can imagine, I never did finish that game, and I never looked favorably on that game either. while looking up to get some details about the game, I discovered that Shadow of the Beast actually had two sequels. It was mainly for the Amiga, and indeed, there is a PlayStation 4 remake that is apparently on the way. So, good things to the franchise and good things to the people who like this game, but it'll be forever remembered as this game where no matter what, whether I went left or right, I would eventually get killed and have to start over again. And yes. So, I should give it some credit. The music was by David Whittaker, and it is actually pretty good. So, what I will play now is the tune that I heard constantly played as I made my way across that plane. It is called Arabon's Revenge, apparently named after the main protagonist, emancipated slave called Arabon. And I think I will listen to it, and as you listen to it, you can either appreciate it for the music or think about how much pain this game caused me. This has been David Collins with BitNote. Thank you for listening. The